Live from America's finest city, this is Real Talk San Diego on ESPN 1700. And now, your hosts, Ryan White and David McKelvin.
Welcome, welcome, welcome. We have with us today Keith McKenzie, founding partner, financial advisor, Delphi Private, right? That's your website, Delphi Private Advisors being the company.
That's correct.
Welcome. And as you might have guessed, he is a financial advisor. Also with us, seventh time repeat offender. I actually looked this up. Seven times. That's a lot.
Seven times.
Seven time repeat offender, Mr. Sean Weber, the love doctor in the house with Brave Weber and Mac, his website, bravewebermac.com. He is a family law attorney and is going to be talking to us. Well, a kind of a continuing theme you've had throughout is alternative dispute resolution methods, but more specifically, your analogy today is going to be dolphins versus sharks.
That's
right. That right?
Yeah, there's a big difference between a dolphin or a shark, and you can decide which one you'd prefer to have.
Okay, so framing the context just a little bit here, we are, of course, talking about family law and most commonly divorce, and one of the things Sean has continued to advocate is the multiple methods of going through the divorce process. Isn't that right?
That's correct. There's many different ways to get a divorce, and I always tell people the decision of how you divorce is almost as important as the decision whether to divorce.
Really? Almost as important?
Almost. Not quite as important, obviously.
Got it. Okay.
But there's different ways to do it. You know, there's the traditional method that people think of, which is the adversarial process where you
right.
go to court and you lawyer up and you duke it out. It's adversarial. Attorneys are encouraged to be zealous advocates, which
right,
means they're
right.
going to be kind of crazy, you know?
Yeah.
And that's what we're told is actually ethical representation, to be zealous advocates.
That's what law school teaches you?
That's what law school teaches us.
Okay.
It's the right way to do things. But
okay.
the problem is when you're talking about families and transitioning a family from two married people with kids to now two divorced people that still have children, the adversarial process is kind of a problem because it encourages people to, A, spend a whole lot of money on litigation. So you're putting money into my kid's 529 account instead of your own kid's 529
okay,
account.
Okay.
And the second is it's so adversarial that the relationship that, you know, maybe it was already strained because of the divorce, now it's going to be worse. There's no hope of you being able to be effective co-parents, I call it. People that work together, you still got these beautiful kids to raise. What are you going to do now? And so
right.
we've for years have been looking at doing different kinds of options. One is mediation, where you have a neutral person sit at a table with two people and help them reach a resolution on their own. They decide themselves what's going to happen with their family and not a stranger in black robes. And it's a cheaper way to go, and it's faster, and it's more consensual. It's looking for a way it's a good fit for this family instead of applying the cookie cutter that they would receive if they were at family court.
Yeah, so we're talking with Sean Weber here, family law attorney with Brave Weber Mac, his website, bravewebermac.com. So if I'm to understand correctly, the traditional method of going to court and litigation might be plan C or D through your firm. I mean, obviously it depends on what the client wants, but you offer A, B, and C.
That's right.
Right?
That's right. I mean, litigation is just simply one option. Some people have to litigate, right? Because things are maybe so toxic or there's such a level of trust that it's impossible for you to sit across the table from each other. Although, even if that's hard to do, sitting across the table, if I can get people in a room together, I can usually help them resolve the case. The other thing that's available is collaborative practice, and I'm actually the incoming president of Collaborative Practice California. Woohoo for
wow,
me.
Wow, royalty here.
And, you know, you can actually go to the website cpcal.org and learn about collaborative practice. It's been in California for about 10 years. They're celebrating their 10-year anniversary as an organization.
Okay.
And with collaborative practice, you have attorneys that sign an agreement with the parties that says we're never going to cross the threshold of the courtroom.
Why is that important? Why do I care?
The reason you care is now your attorney has gone from a position where he needs to be a positional shark kind of attorney adversarial to a more solutions-oriented attorney. I'm not thinking about, as counsel, I'm not thinking I have to posture every second for my client. I'm thinking I'm going to sit here, I'm never going to go to court, and what I'm looking for is solutions for this family.
Well, it kind of seems to me where the shark might be trying to get essentially everything. A dolphin, or the more collaborative approach, is kind of looking for some middle ground with respect to stuff in hopes of preserving the feelings, so to speak. Is that a general
idea?
That's
right, because, you know, divorce is more than just a legal process. It's a human experience. And so one of the reasons collaborative is such a great process is you can bring in mental health professionals to help with the kids or with emotions that are happening during the divorce. And you can bring in a financial specialist, someone who's an expert on finances, because, frankly, I went to law school so I wouldn't have to do math. You know, and so having a financial person in there who maybe charges a lower billable rate than the exorbitant fees that the attorney charges, you can really get a better product for the family.
I can certainly see how being over the top as a shark can possibly win more stuff at the expense of losing emotion. And I know you've commonly talked about, given the scenario of, do you want to be able to dance at your daughter's wedding? I've heard you say that so many times.
That's right.
And there's a monetary amount associated with that, right? How much are you willing to give up today so you still can retain the family tomorrow? And that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, and I'm not suggesting that people give up stuff that they shouldn't get. You know, they need to know what their rights are, and
sure,
that's why you have an attorney in the room with you. But at the same time, you're able to make judgment calls for what's best for your family. You know?
I get that.
And you know, again, yeah, do you want to dance at your daughter's wedding? That's a wonderful question to ask. Or, you know, do you want to be able to have a good relationship with this person post-divorce? Do you want to constantly be worried about what your ex is thinking or what he's going to do next?
Right.
Or do you want to have a relationship that's more solutions-based? And, okay, yeah, our marriage didn't work, but, you know, we invested a lot in each other, and we have these beautiful children, and we'd like to move on. Or maybe we don't have kids, but we just have wealth that we don't want to just squander and waste on nonsense, which would be the cookie cutter approach that you would do at court, you know? And so that's really the key difference between a shark and a dolphin. The shark will take the cookie cutter approach every time. The dolphin will think about what is tailor fitted for the family.
We're talking with Sean Weber, family law attorney with Brave Weber and Mac. His website, bravewebermac.com, bravewebermac.com. Funny enough, we're talking about shark versus a dolphin, not a conversation that I initially thought we'd be having today with an attorney, but that's kind of Sean's thing here, in that going for the jugular every time isn't necessarily the right case. I mean, you certainly do have the tools to be the shark if that's what's necessary, but what I think is really neat is the, let's call it self-control, so to speak,
mm-hmm,
the additional skills to understand that there's other things at play other than getting more of the stuff.
That's right.
And so you've got a substantial list here of, well, I guess it's shark versus dolphin. But before we get into that, I think it's, let's go back and reiterate just a few things with respect to what can go wrong through the shark approach. I mean, it takes us to court most commonly. And with respect to court system, you mentioned here it's overwhelmed and budget cuts. What's going on with that? I mean, that's something that the layperson, as myself, doesn't really see on the radar.
That's correct. You know, the Union Tribune did a piece back in January 17th about court cuts in San Diego, and it's something we've been experiencing as family law attorneys for a while, and that is that the budget cuts are really significant. Last year we had almost 30,000 divorce cases, family law cases, going through just in San Diego County. And it's just overwhelming, and they keep cutting staff and budgets because they just don't have the funds from the state to do what they need to do. And so we're having to do stuff like bring our own court reporters to court and pay that. To get a hearing is harder. If you have a judgment, just to process your marital settlement agreement can take months because the court is overwhelmed. It's sitting on a clerk's desk who is just, all she's doing all day is processing judgments. We even have a judge in one court who is actually taking her judgments home with her at night so she can process them because they simply can't keep up. And it's remarkable. I mean, the court staff, what they're doing is really incredible, but it's just, they're so overwhelmed, and they actually love it that there are people out there that want to offer consensual dispute resolution opportunities so that their docket is lightened a little bit. So that the people that really need court, like domestic violence and mm-hmm, things like that, they have that available to them. They have that access to justice.
And
they're not clogged up with people that really don't necessarily need to be there. If they could just sit in the room with a consensual dispute resolver or a dolphin, they could be able to move on with their lives without even having to set foot in the courtroom.
Well, I think the takeaway here is, yes, there is a place for a shark and there is a place for a dolphin. And what I think is really unique is when going through the process, identifying that there is more than one choice. Right, you've commonly talked about multiple methods: mediation, collaboration, of course, also going to court. And when interviewing your divorce attorney, if you're to mention, and you said this to me in the green room, do you offer collaborative? And they ask you, "What is that?" You may want to question how cookie cutter their approach is. I think is really what you're saying is all attorneys are not created equal. One more time, Sean Weber, family law attorney. His website, BraveWeberMac.com. That's the website, BraveWeberMac.com. When we come back, we're going to talk with Keith McKenzie, founding partner, financial advisor, Delphi Private Advisors. His website, DelphiPrivate.com. Talk about investment psychology used by the ultra wealthy, but more specifically, prospect theory. And what's the game we're going to play?
We're going to play a little Monty Hall. So
Monty Hall. Okay.
Pick a door.
Ahead of us when we come back. Mama, take this back. Welcome back. We've just heard from Sean Weber, the Love Doctor, family law attorney, Brave Weber and Mac, his website, BraveWeberMac.com. And we will come back to hear some, well, some analogies about the shark versus the dolphin concept that he's, well, developing, refining, creating, all of the above, right?
That's right.
Okay, shifting gears to Keith McKenzie, founding partner, financial advisor with Delphi Private Advisors. His website is Delphi Private. One more time, D-E-L-P-H-I, private.com. Going to talk about investment psychology used by the ultra wealthy. And I would think that the psychology would not be as crucial as what you're actually investing in, but I think what you're going to tell me is psychology very much drives the investments.
But yeah, it's actually kind of interesting that we spend a good part of our day not only in the collaboration with other advisors, but also you know, on the investment stuff. But a big part of it comes down to how the client feels about what's going on in their portfolio.
Makes sense. That makes a lot of sense. So you have, what is this, 8 points that discuss investment psychology, but only one of them you're going to illustrate with a game. So let's start with that. This is prospect theory, right? What in the world does that mean?
Well, prospect theory basically says that people value gains and losses very differently. So okay, as humans, we're really, really poor at you know, quantifying risks. So there are some ways to think about this, and you have to understand that these things are going on in every one of our decision-making processes.
Okay.
So, yeah, you want to just jump right in?
Let's do it.
Okay. So this is there's only two options here. So you got A or B, so door number one or door number two. And it really comes down to a monetary game. I'm going to give you a couple of choices, two choices, and then I'm going to ask you if you would prefer door number one or door number two.
Okay.
And there is a right answer and a wrong answer here from a financial perspective, but most people get this wrong. So I'm just going to tee it up for you.
Okay.
Okay. Door number one, you can win $3,000.
Okay. I'm writing this down. $3,000.
Yep.
Okay.
Better take some notes. Math is really tough here.
Oh, God.
$3,000. You have 100% guarantee that you are going to win $3,000 if you pick door number one.
Okay.
Okay. Door number two, you can win $4,000, but you have an 80% probability of winning $4,000. Okay. Don't think too long on this. This is not that tough. Which door do you pick?
Well, I'm going to make my attempt at door number one. I'm going to take door number one.
Okay, door number one. Sean, you need to get on this too. So what door are you taking?
Okay. So I'm looking at this and I'm thinking the one door, I have 100% shot of winning $3,000.
Door number one, 100%, $3,000.
And the other door, it's an 80% shot of winning $4,000.
That's correct.
Well, I'm very risk averse.
Risk averse.
So you're taking door number one, too?
I'm going to take door number one because at least I know I'm going to get $3,000.
Super boring.
Which is kind of funny because I think you can see my notes. All right. So that is exactly what most people pick. It's the financial wrong decision to pick. So, but why is that, right? So there's very simple math on this.
It's, yeah, I see the math.
The expected value is the percentage guarantee versus or against the amount that you could win. So the expected value of option one is $3,000. The expected value of option two is $3,200. The correct decision is option two. And most people don't do this. And this is because we value, we have a very tough time evaluating risk, and we value gains and losses very differently as humans.
Well, you skipped over the math there, so I think it's important to show your work a little bit. Essentially, you multiply the two numbers.
You multiply
right?
the numbers.
So let's do the math there. You take $3,000 times one, right? And you wind up with guaranteed of
$3,000. Guaranteed value is 3,000. Expected value is the term, yes.
And you take $4,000 times 0.8, or 80%,
correct.
And that's you come up with a $3,200.
That's correct. So,
got it.
Yeah, this is very simple math, but it illustrates a point that people tend to pick the wrong financial choice because of their emotional biases.
In this case, being overly cautious is what Sean and I both did to our own $200 detriment. Can you believe that, Sean?
I can't believe it.
Okay, kept the math simple for you.
Got it. I appreciate that.
Do you want to try another one on the other side?
Very much.
All right. Now that you got the hang of this, you know how to do the math, so it should be very easy for everyone to get this one right. So option one, you have a guaranteed loss, 100% guaranteed that you're going to lose $5,000.
Oof.
Okay, so you're already doing the expected value on this one. Oof. Number two, you have a 75% chance of losing $7,000. Okay, math is quick.
Got it. Bad investment either way.
Yeah. where are you going? It's a game show. Remember, it's a game show.
Okay. So I'm going to do, as you mentioned, 5,000 times 1 gives me 5,000, 75, 7,000 times 0.75. I'm guessing that leaves me somewhere in the vicinity of just above $5,000. So my guaranteed loss of 5,000 would be better in this case, so I would think. It's a tough thing to say, though.
But you got the math right, but can you pick door number one?
Right.
Can you do it?
I would have a hard time picking it, even though I would rationally understand. You know, guaranteeing yourself a loss, that's scary to me. But, you know, hey, I've got a 25% shot of not losing. Mm-hmm. Is that what I'm hearing here? I don't know. You want to at least have a shot of not losing your money.
That's exactly right.
Well, that's why we're talking about investment psychology, right? That's the whole idea. We all saw the numbers, right? The numbers were what the numbers were, but it is difficult to choose the guaranteed loss. And I think essentially this is the advice that the ultra wealthy would be given and make the right decision that perhaps the layman doesn't have the opportunity to do so.
That's correct. So the ultra wealthy and even the wealthy and people that have access to really good advisors should be getting very good, sound financial advice. And not saying that
should be. I like that.
Should be,
I like
right?
that.
But it doesn't mean that if the ordinary investor if they can understand some of these concepts and know that they're going on, that they'll be able to make better decisions for themselves. It doesn't mean that they have to go find an advisor to help them guide them through this stuff. But at least if they have an understanding that it's going on and happening, mm-hmm. possibly they can make better decisions for their own financial choices.
So if you can bring yourself in this scenario to making the decision to guarantee yourself a loss of $5,000, maybe you don't need any more help. But if you're struggling with making that decision, as I think we all are, it may make sense to reach out and seek some additional advice, right?
You know, I think that that's one of the big differences. You know, when you end up having a lot of money, you tend to have a very large team of advisors helping you out, and they coordinate very well and they collaborate, and the benefit to the client is that they end up with a much better place. They're able to push off some of these emotional hurdles onto their advisory team, and individual investors just generally don't have that luxury. So try to understand that they're going on and deal with them yourself, and have go into these situations with a little bit of information. You'll do better.
We're talking with Keith McKenzie, founding partner of Delphi Private Advisor. His website is DelphiPrivate.com, DelphiPrivate.com. Talking about investment psychology, we just talked a little bit about prospect theory, and we're going to move on ahead to overconfidence. Is that as simple as it sounds?
It's as simple as it sounds. Everybody wants to live in Lake Wobegon, right? They all think that they're above average, and this happens in the investment world all the time. And basically what it says is people put too much weight on their own ability, and they might have a big win in their past, or they might have something that gives them that overconfidence, but generally we're just hardwired to be overconfident in our investment decisions.
And by that, you mean choosing the winner? Is that what you mean? Choosing the right stock? Confident that it's not going to go down because you chose it? Is that what you mean?
It could be anything. Any of the decisions okay. that we're making, right?
Okay.
You just have to realize that we tend to be overconfident in the decisions that we make. And there was actually a survey done in this area for individual investors. And what they found is that individual investors tended to trade more if they had this overconfidence bias, and they tended to do worse. So it actually does impact the bottom line for most investors.
And so when you go out and utilize a financial advisor, one of the things they would be able to shelter you from would be this overconfidence?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, it's kind of funny because they also surveyed 300 fund managers, you know, professional managers that run products, you know, in the financial industry. And when surveyed about their own ability, 74% of them said that they were above average. You know, if you did the math there, you would say that 50% were above and 50%
right.
were below.
Right.
However, when they surveyed them, the fund managers, 74 were above average. And of the remaining 26%, most of those were average. So that basically says that most people are not below average in the fund management world, which is completely untrue.
Interesting. Overreaction to new information.
Okay, so everybody is bombarded by so much information every day in the news media, and everybody wants to take action immediately based on what's popping up on CNBC or Fox or CNN or what's happening around the world. And rational financial behavior would basically say that a lot of the information is priced in fairly quickly. So it becomes very difficult for individual investors to, A, tune out some of this information, absorb it, recognize that most of it gets priced into or has been priced into markets fairly quickly. And what you're really seeing when the prices react to new information are really overreactions that will eventually come back the other direction.
So what do you mean by priced in?
Well, if you believe in efficient markets, which, you know, capital markets theory basically says that it's the valuation of a security, and there's somebody that values on the buy side and the sell side, and it reaches equilibrium based on all the information that's available in the marketplace. So all the information gets readily and quickly digested into the valuation of a stock. So bad news comes out for a certain security, that stock reacts, it then tends to overreact as that information starts to get disseminated out to the general public.
Makes a lot of sense.
Makes a lot of sense, but nobody does it. So
we're talking with Keith McKenzie, founding partner financial advisors, his company, Delphi Private Advisor. His website is DelphiPrivate.com. That's the website, DelphiPrivate.com. We're talking about investment psychology. So we're far and away not choosing stocks, but we're looking back at the mental picture that would drive someone in a direction, right?
That's absolutely right. I mean, people tend to, and we're hardwired to just do the wrong things. And you need to understand this. And,
great.
You know, if you don't, you know, at least take a pause when making financial decisions and really try to understand whether the direction you're going is a rational financial direction, right? It's tough.
Yeah, it sounds tough. When we come back, we're going to hear more from Sean Weber. I'm going to have him tell us some stories about some of the benefits of his dolphin approach ahead of us when we come back. Welcome back, ESPN 1700 AM. It's the Real Estate Radio Hour. We've heard from Keith McKenzie, founding partner, financial advisor with Delphi Private Advisors. His website is Delphi Private. One more time, it's DelphiPrivate Weber.com, talking about investment psychology, and investment psychology more specifically used by the ultra wealthy and how they navigate. We talked about some potential gains and losses and how to calculate that. We talked about prospect theory and confidence. And before we transition to the dolphin shark model, I'm going to speak with the last thing on anchoring, right? What is the concept of anchoring?
Well, anchoring basically is a tendency to attach or anchor our thoughts to a reference point. So it could be a real estate valuation. It could be a stock, what you paid for the stock, something like that. But it tends to have people make irrational decisions when coming and dealing with financial assets.
So I have a house. Somebody told me 3 years ago when the market was great, a neighbor who had a home that was 1,000 square feet bigger than mine, had a view, a pool, and a bunch of upgrades, said it was worth $1 million, and now I want that same price. Is that kind of the idea?
That's kind of the idea, and maybe it was actually worth $1 million. I mean, maybe you had valuations of it, and it was worth $1 million, but the market today says that house is worth $900,000. The rational decision when you go to sell that would be to sell it for what the market value is of that house. However, that starts to play into how you deal with that asset going forward, and you'll make the wrong decision because you're anchored on the value of $1 million, which is irrational in today's market.
That concept is the most prevalent obstacle in my entire business for both buyers and sellers, right? There's an enormous amount of anchoring that goes on both sides for all kinds of crazy stuff. Zillow, Redfin, Trulia, the news. I mean, there's all kinds of anchoring going on for, I would think, really irrational reasons.
It plays in everybody's life. So everybody's got examples of how anchoring is affecting their financial decisions, whether it's in, you know, maybe in divorce or whatever. I think but in financial markets, it's crazy, the behavior, because they anchor and they'll hold a stock way too long because of this, or they'll sell a stock that's doing really, really well. They'll sell it too early.
Got it. Well, I want to come back and hear a few more examples of that. But Sean, you were mentioning when we're dividing stuff down the middle, this often comes into play as well.
Yeah, anchoring is a huge problem in a divorce negotiation because you add an emotional piece to what people are anchoring onto. So maybe you have a house and you have a person who, I have to have the house. I'm the one that took care of the house. I was the housekeeper. I raised the kids in the house. The house is the marriage museum. And they will apply artificial values to that house in their mind, in their psychology, so that when it comes time to negotiate, they will actually trade away things to their detriment. For instance, they'll have a beautiful house, but they'll have no retirement when the divorce is over.
Mm.
Or they'll be house poor. They'll have this beautiful house, but they have to pay for it. They have to keep it up, and they can't afford it.
Right.
Or another thing that'll happen is people will anchor onto a support number that someone's told them is a possible number, but may not be appropriate for this particular family as far as cash flow is concerned. And that can get in the way of negotiating a deal that works best for both of them. And you can actually have people make very irrational decisions about support because they don't think about the tax implications of the support number.
What are the tax implications?
For instance, alimony is tax deductible.
From the payor.
And the payee, it's taxable to her or him.
Oh.
And so what'll happen a lot of times is when you run it through the support software, it actually shows what, you know, the tax implications are for each. And you will find that sometimes a person will do better to pay a higher amount of support. It actually creates money for the family because what you're doing is you're using the IRS, you're using the Internal Revenue Code to put money in the other person's pocket and also put money back in your pocket. So you get a deduction at your higher rate because you have a higher income. And then the support recipient, she pays taxes on it, but she'll pay it at a lower rate. So it actually creates wealth for the family. And
interesting.
There's a lot of work that you have to go through to be able to show people this in a very rational.
That doesn't seem like it would be easy to convince someone of.
Right. What? You mean if I...
the payor, anyway.
Or who gets the tax deduction? You mean if I give him the tax deductions, I'm going to get more support and that's good? Yes, that is good. You want more support and you'll give him the tax deductions. And then he's like, well, wait a minute. Why should I pay more support? Well, the reason is because of this, the tax law, you know? And so there's some work that you can go through with this. And people have to, you know, and that's what makes collaborative practice such a wonderful opportunity for people because you have financial experts in the room, you have psychologists in the room or mental health professionals that can help make sure that the decisions that people are making are based on rational information instead of, you know, just what we as human beings bring to the table.
And I would think commonly a lot of decisions are made, you know, in a back room, so to speak, when you're in the litigation approach. They're not made in a forum where it can be ratified or clarified if necessary.
Right. And one of the problems with litigation and the shark approach is that the clients are told not to talk to each other.
Mm-hmm.
That's called client control. You know, I don't know about you, but when I'm a client, I don't necessarily want to be told that I have to be controlled. You know,
okay.
And so what the dolphin will do will actually be to bring all the decision makers into a room together and let's have a dialogue. Let's talk about this. And it won't be this formal adversarial kind of experience. It'll be a much more open human experience.
Yeah. When finances are involved, I mean, the collaborative approach always works out better from financial advisor, attorneys, accountants, all around the same table. We see it in outside of divorces as well. But clearly, in that situation, you can optimize the family's wealth, which is, you know, should be the outcome,
right?
If you really want to have a long-standing relationship,
should be. We're talking with Sean Weber, family law attorney. His website, bravewebermac.com, bravewebermac.com. You have a blog post up there, lengthy, a couple videos, right, of the shark versus the dolphin concept. Now, what percentage of the time are you able to resolve your cases from a non-litigation perspective? And I guess litigation could still involve a little bit of dolphinish, but it tends to transition to the shark. Is that the way that works?
It can, yeah. I mean, honestly, the way I practice, because I'm a dolphin, there are dolphin litigators too. You know, and in fact, I talked to a well-known attorney here in town, and she said the really best attorneys, even the best litigators, are dolphins. And the way they approach things, they may be in a litigation model because that's where they are, but the way they will interact with their clients and with counsel is much more from a dolphin perspective. So first of all, a shark will be overly and unnecessarily aggressive because someone told them someday that that's what they were supposed to do as a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
And you've seen the pictures of them on the park bench, you know, the bus stop bench. They've got the nasty scowl on their face.
Okay.
The dolphin lawyer, though, will be tough when he's needed. You know, but he understands that you catch more flies with sugar than with vinegar, you know, and so they will work in a non-adversarial way to negotiate a deal. But, you know, when they get in the courtroom, they know how to be tough. You know, dolphins do have teeth.
Sure.
And the other thing is a shark lawyer will avoid, you know, emotional discussions. They'll just shut it down. Whereas a dolphin will want to see what's going on here in the emotions and will actually want to talk about that with their client and, if necessary, bring in, like in a collaborative practice context, bring in a mental health professional who can act as a coach to kind of help guide the client through the emotions of the process.
Yeah, it does seem like the emotional side or the human side is really the big difference here. That's potentially what we're preserving is the emotional side.
Right.
By taking a... collaborative approach to the solution as opposed to trying to move the meter from 50-50 to 70-30, potentially we're sacrificing the emotional aspect of this.
And people don't realize how much emotions cost.
Yeah.
I was talking to a client today, and he's trying to settle a deal, and he's frankly giving more than he probably would need to under the law, but he wants a deal, and he's thinking, you know, I'm going to have a heart attack if I have to litigate this case. You know, and I can't tell him as an attorney, yes, you should take that deal because I don't want you to have a heart attack. I can tell him this is what you're up against. This is what the law says, and you make the decision. And I'm not going to force that on him. And he's making what I believe is a rational choice to preserve his own health and his own life and, frankly, the relationship that he's going to have with his ex-spouse.
Right. That's a big one.
The other thing that happens with sharks is they will apply unnecessary and expensive cookie-cutter procedures to the case every time. You know, they'll notice the other side for depositions and formal discovery, and that's extraordinarily expensive. A dolphin attorney will just call the other side and say, hey, what kind of stuff do you need from me? And let me get it to you so that we can resolve this case. And could you, by the way, send this over? And they'll do it in an informal way. And they'll understand that that tailoring the process to the individual client is much more important. So if you need a deposition, do it. But if you don't need a deposition, but you're just doing it because of a standard operating procedure because you're a shark, well, that's not helping your client. That's bad advocacy.
And to bill for it, too. I mean, they don't come
for
free.
Well, that's it. You know, it's the billable hour. And there's some people that believe, well, I need to do all of these things because I know I can bill for it.
Right.
And I find in my own practice that I actually do better because I get more repeat business. I get more repeat referrals from past clients because they know I'm not going to just essentially rape their family with standard operating procedures. I'm going to apply something that's solutions-based and works for their family in a collaborative sort of way.
It's an interesting concept for sure. Sean Weber, family law attorney, bravewebermac.com. That's his website, bravewebermac.com. Now, you're actually jumping into the process of attempting to train attorneys to employ the same dolphin concept, right?
Yes, I'm very happy to teach what I've learned, and that is that you don't have to be a shark to be an effective advocate if you're a lawyer. And I'm beginning that process of training other attorneys on how to be a dolphin lawyer, how to do dolphin lawyering. And I think it's something that's very overdue in the legal system, especially when you're talking about things like families, where, you know, the shark approach isn't really as effective. And I'd honestly say in any kind of practice of law, even in, you know, transactional work, business litigation, that sort of thing, the really smart litigators know that the more effective thing to do for their client is really to take the dolphin approach as opposed to the really aggressive shark approach. Most cases settle, and it's because attorneys understand that a settlement is important. So my point of view is, well, then the way you get to the settlement can really make a difference for how the overall transaction is going to go.
I get that. I get that. And when you're all done, if possible, everybody to be as emotionally sound as possible. That's general, right. General idea. Well, that's interesting how you're bringing that approach to others. When we come back, we're going to hear more from Keith McKenzie about investment psychology ahead of us when we come back. Talking with Sean Weber, family law attorney with Brave, Weber, and Mac. For more information on the collaborative process, cpcal.org. That's the website, cpcal.org. Now, shifting gears back to Keith McKenzie, investment psychology used by the ultra-wealthy. Now, why do we care about all this? What are we building up to? What's the general concept of why we care about investment psychology?
Well, I think if people have a basic understanding of how their brain works when it comes to making financial decisions, they might actually be able to maybe slow down, think about it, say, hey, I remember that concept. I can't remember the name of it, but you know, maybe I should think about this a little bit more and realize that I'm hardwired to possibly make the wrong decision. So maybe they'll make a slightly different decision next time.
Well, I have to assume this is not the first time you've brought these 8 points to light, and we can't be the first person you've ever presented this to. So with that assumption, how frequently are you able to present these 8 points and they stick and people actually use them?
Well, we don't actually formally present these points very often, and there's a lot more, by the way, that kind of get into some of the psychology of really, really wealthy people. But, you know, it's just understanding. So I have to keep these in the back of my mind when I'm having conversations with people, and they'll present a set of facts around something, and then I'll have to think about those set of facts from a rational perspective, and oftentimes they fall into one of these 8 categories.
Got it. So, okay. What is gambler's fallacy?
Well, the gambler's fallacy is basically says that a set of random events impacts the next set of random events. And we all can think about this in different ways, but flipping a coin is a great one. Roulette tables is great. I love it when I see people in Vegas on this one.
Okay.
So you can take this to Vegas and remember it the next time you walk by a roulette table and you see an entire row of red numbers, and you are tempted to bet on black because obviously if there's been a lot of reds coming up, the next one has to have a higher probability of being black. And it's actually the same probability every time that wheel gets spun. However, our mind tricks us into thinking, hey, 8 reds in a row, the next one must be black.
Got it.
Might have just saved some people some money there. I don't know.
So how do I apply this to choosing stocks, I'm guessing?
Well, in everybody's kind of everyday life, they use all these random events that happen with maybe a financial investment. And then they try to apply the next set of random events as if it's going to make a difference based on what's just happened. So we have to realize that past random events really are random events, and the next set of random events are. So you can't just put all of that history of random things happening and use that as an evaluation criteria for that next investment.
Right. So the goal here would be to select which elements are random and should be discarded, and select which elements are not random and should be included in making the next investment decision, right?
Well, basically, it comes down to having a, you know, in finance, you really want to have a philosophy of how your money is managed and how things are going to work. And when you start deviating from that philosophy, or you start getting tugged into emotional type decisions, most often those decisions are not good.
Got it.
So a lot of people just don't have a philosophy. So that's another talk show, right?
Okay, good enough. We are talking with Keith McKenzie, founding partner of Delphi Private Advisors. His website is DelphiPrivate.com. That's the website, DelphiPrivate.com, talking about investment psychology. We've talked about prospect theory, overconfidence, overreaction, anchoring, most recently, gambler's fallacy. And what about hindsight bias? Seems like that may play well in this.
Yeah, I think everyone can relate to this one. That's basically a person believes that, you know, basically after the fact, that the onset of some past event was predictable and it was completely obvious. And, you know, how many times have you seen this, Sean, where somebody has a little hindsight bias?
Oh, it's constant. I could have negotiated that deal all by myself. I didn't need you. Or, gosh, I have buyer's remorse. I should have done this. Or just looking at what the past was, thinking that's going to predict the future.
Yep. Think tech bubble, right? go back to the run-up of the dot-coms, and in hindsight, you know, our view of that is very different. It was obvious that there was a bubble, right? At the time, it was not obvious to a lot of the people, and a lot of investors lost a ton of money because they got tied up in what was going on, which was a lot of other behavioral finance. But basically, in hindsight, looking back, you would have said, the investor would have said, that was obvious. I avoided that.
Got it. Got it.
It's not the case, because a lot of people lost a lot of money.
Not the case. No, yeah. Not the case. Okay. Mental accounting.
Okay. So how many people have a cookie jar on their counter, right? In the old days, you might toss a quarter or a nickel or something in this cookie jar, and that's the way you'd start to save. But that's a form of mental accounting. And you know, it's a tendency for people to separate their money into separate accounts based on a variety of kind of subjective criteria, right? You might be saving for a vacation and putting it in a special account. It might actually be a bank account. It might be a cookie jar. It might be just mentally the way you're thinking about it. But it can drive irrational behavior because they are saving for money in this one account, but they might have incredible credit card debt that they're paying 20% interest on. The rational decision would be to pay down the credit card debt before you start to save for a vacation. However, people love to do mental accounting. And they probably do it in Sean's world. They probably do it in all kinds of things. They do it in real estate, I'm sure. But you know, when you start exhibiting these types of factors, like, well, maybe if I just put this money there, or that money came from here, so it's going to that purpose, you really have to think of a dollar in and where does it go out? Where should it be going?
We're talking with Keith McKenzie, founding partner, financial advisor of Delphi Private, talking about investment psychology. Just went over mental accounting, and we're going to talk about the herd mentality as our last one on our list.
The last one on our list, we did a little foreshadowing when we thought about the tech bubble here, but you know, humans, I believe, are just hardwired to act like a herd, and we tend to do things in a herd that we wouldn't do on our own. And you know, think of the tech bubble, right? I mean, people, if you were the only guy buying pets.com at an incredible valuation, you know, people would say you weren't very smart. But when everybody's doing it, you're along with the herd. It somehow feels comfortable to spend crazy amounts of money for a company that's going to ship dog food around the world. So that's an example of herd mentality. People, as investors, tend to make poor investment decisions when they start to see a lot of people rushing into doing it.
Got it. So it kind of seems like the reason we're talking about these is bringing light to mistakes that people make simply because we're hardwired to do so, right?
Well, again, it's easy to see the mistake in the rearview mirror. And what advisors try to do is to see those mistakes coming, right?
Right.
To start to see the emotions that are driving decisions. And they try to step in and say, you know, I recognize that. I understand why you're feeling that way. But let me walk through the financial you know, the financial numbers, or let me walk you through the picture of what's really going on here, and maybe we can come up with a different solution. And unfortunately, a lot of people don't have that type of, you know, advisory team to walk through these things. So if you can just remember some of these types of behavioral traits and how you might be wired to make decisions that's not optimal for yourself, I think that's the point to talk about.
If you can't remember, you can go to his website. It's Delphi Private, D-E-L-P-H-I, private.com. Keith McKenzie, founding partner, financial advisor, investment psychology, DelphiPrivate.com. Also, we had Sean Weber, family law attorney, with Brave Weber and Mack. The website for the firm there is BraveWeberMack.com. Also, check out CPCal.org. CPCal.org. That is the collaborative practice website, which you are now the president, right?
Or incoming president.
Incoming president, excuse me. CPCal.org. More information on the collaborative approach. Gentlemen, I want to thank you both for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you. It was a lot of fun.
Pleasure.
Until next week. Yeah, 'cause I'm missing you. I'm